You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello and welcome to the Bald Move Television Podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for all of television here on baldmove.com. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And today, this Monday, we are talking about the Romanoffs, Episode 5, Bright and High Circle. Jim, how high and how bright was this circle for you?
It wasn't the dim and low circle. I mean, I didn't hate it. It was kind of on par with everything else that I've seen from the Romanoffs. I don't think it was awful. I don't think it was great. Somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I this is a pretty messy episode because it's trying to say something, and I think the thing it feels like to me, the thing it's trying to say is kind of, you know, in the era of Me Too, and as we talked about in the very first episode, Matthew Weiner's kind of involvement in that is false witness the worst crime that one can commit?
Obviously not. I mean, I can think of a litany of crimes that are worse.
I feel like murder is the worst thing you can do. Maybe mass murder.
Yeah.
is the worst crime one can commit, because that's the one that is, you know, like there's no kind of appeal from. Death, the abyss. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, because like you can go to lots of places on the internet to see a lot of very interesting and nuanced takedowns of this episode, and a lot of people bemoaning Matthew Weiner's whatever artistic vision. I'm going to try to talk in terms, I mean, I'm definitely going to talk about that stuff, but I first want to talk about, I guess, the purely subjective artistic opinion, in which I thought this was an unusually stilted episode of the Romanoffs, thinking that a lot of the episodes of Romanoffs have been stilted, and to the point where there was a lot of music this episode. I thought, like, is Matthew Weiner trying to go for, like, his version of a Broadway play? Because all of the acting was very stiff and stagey. I thought some of the conversations remarkably poorly edited. Mm-hmm. Like, Diane Lane would say something, like, heated, and then it'd throw back to Ron Livingston, and there'd be, like, a second and a half pause while he's, like, sitting there on his mark before he talked. I'm like, what the flow of this is just all, like, all fucked up and inartful. I mean, the show looked amazing, as always. It's got a very high caliber of talent. It's just nothing felt like it worked through most of the hour.
Yeah, I absolutely felt that sitting there watching it, that I was watching something that was intentionally constructed in a way that it doesn't appeal to me. The thing is, I don't recall ever feeling this way in Mad Men, where I look at something and go, boy, that beat really didn't play right. So I don't know where to put the blame for that. In this show, because
Matthew Weiner wrote, directed, and produced and created this thing. He did have
a co-writer
on this, but I'm going to go with Matthew Weiner probably to blame for this.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so, but I guess he had other talent working with him on Mad Men in a way that, you know, covered up some of his perhaps tendencies, at least as I'm perceiving them in this show.
Right.
To try, it's almost like there were moments where he thought he was giving the character a beat to think, but instead it came across as this character isn't actually thinking. They're just sort of waiting to say their line.
Yeah.
I'm with you. It felt a little weird and clunky.
On the other hand, I did like about everything, just about everything involving Andrew Rannells, I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name, except for the fact that he is 40 years old and he's convincingly playing a mid-20-something person.
That is the piano teacher?
Yeah. that seems like a little bit much to take. But he's very talented, and like he's able to do some kind of like funny things and some kind of bitchy, snarky things. And I thought all that stuff worked well as like these weird flashbacks that Diane Lang was having as she kind of like him. Her kindergarten age son being transfixed by him practicing, I thought was a pretty good scene. I thought the scene where this kitchen looked like for sale threw up was a pretty funny scene. There's like all these little interesting vignettes that kind of reminded me of like grown up Elijah from the girls television show. But that was kind of the only bright point. And like, I really like Diane Lang. I really like Ron Livingston. And it was kind of painful to see them so muted and working with this material that I didn't think was very interesting or instructive. Hey, before we get too much further into an episode discussion, I want to talk about some housekeeping stuff here at baldmove.com. But first, some housekeeping for the United States of America. If you're a U.S. citizen and are able to do so, please go out and vote tomorrow. The election for Tuesday, November 6th is very important. If you are feeling unprepared, you can go to vote411.org and find a nonpartisan voter's guide where they show you all the candidates will be on your ballot. It's a personalized ballot, and you can make an informed decision based on their stated views, because it provides like interviews and statements of where they stand on various issues, and you can judge accordingly. And then flex your Democratic muscles tomorrow again. It's Tuesday. Don't let anybody tell you differently. It's Tuesday. One other thing is, if you are for whatever reason denied a ballot because of a quibble with your address or whatever, be aware that you have the right in all 50 states to cast a provisional ballot, which is basically saying, yeah, I know there's some bullshit about it, but here is what I would vote if I was allowed to vote. And then they will research, and if you do have the right to vote, that vote will be counted. So they are not required to tell you that. But it's something very handy to know. So vote tomorrow. If you're denied for whatever reason, ask for a provisional ballot and file that ballot, because it is assuming you're not engaging in in-person voting fraud, voter fraud, your vote will be counted. Moving on to Season of the Cage. We're still in the summer of his career where he's making good movies and making good choices. One of his best adaptation, the Charlie Kaufman, I'd never seen this film before until we did this project. It was a really pleasant, wasn't a pleasant surprise because it's a highly regarded film, but it's a very smart film about making an adaptation of a work in Hollywood and what that looks like and what it's like to live with neurosis. It's funny. It's interesting. I think you'll like it. And that's what we're doing for Season of the Cage, or special feature. That's got tons of audio features, members only club features. Check it out on baldmove.com and youtube.com/baldmove. We're also wrapping up the Deuce this week. It's the final episode. Just aired last night. We'll be talking about it tomorrow. You can still get feedback in at tv@baldmove.com. Cecily and I are still doing American Horror Story. There's two episodes left of this season. Jim and I saw Bohemian Rhapsody, the Queen biopic, this last week. Had a really good time doing so. This week, we are seeing the World War II-themed horror film Overlord. That one should be interesting. And then finally, my book, Gods of Thrones, went on sale last week, November 1st. You can buy a digital copy right now on Amazon. Paperbacks will be available in the next week or two. I actually have holding in my hand the proof that I got from Amazon for the book. It'll be available in a couple weeks. But if you want the ebook, you can get it right now. It's Amazon, Gods of Thrones, and there'll be a link in the show notes. That's it. Get back to the episode.
So one other thing that I want to talk about. Two other things, I guess. So I spent at least half of the episode trying to figure out whether or not that was the guy from Workaholics, because goddamn, they look so similar.
Which guy?
The piano teacher.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Obviously. I'm kidding. Okay. But they do look a lot alike, except one's bulkier. And the other thing is, it felt like this whole series really feels like this is Matthew Weiner's attempt to tell the public that he loves high class things. This idea of like, you know, modern day royalty kind of thing, loving the classical music, loving fine wines and fine whiskeys, and just like all of the, you know, the better things in life. It feels like Matthew Weiner is desperately trying to throw it all on the screen, saying, boy, I wish, you know, the people today appreciated these things like I do. Right? Am I crazy in thinking that?
There's certainly an undercurrent of that. And I felt like, to your point that maybe Diane Lang was a bit of a Mary Sue, and that Matthew Weiner's like, oh, I wish I had a dreamy gay man to come by and tell me I earned everything, and this is a result of my own hard work and being a good person, and not just economic imbalances of the system that's just random. I feel you.
Okay, those are the only two things that I want to talk about before we get into more meatier topics.
Another point, I guess, to add on to that is I remember thinking that a lot of stuff in Mad Men is very thought-provoking. Mm-hmm. But now I'm thinking, because every time like Don Draper took a stand that seemed like, you know, very with it or progressive, you always adjusted it for like, well, I guess it's progressive in terms of a guy in 1968 or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, which is like... You know, Don is able to be forwards thinking about women and race. He was a little bit, you know, he didn't wish a gay man wrong, but anything ill, but also doesn't understand why they just can't stay in the closet and stop rocking the boat. And it's a way to like, you kind of could give, you know, Don this high and bright circle, this halo of his own. And then anytime he was bad, like when he was a misogynist or when he was a litterer or when Roger got into blackface, you could always just say, well, it's, you know, these guys, what are you going to expect? That was a long time ago. I feel like this show is outing Matthew Weiner as a bit of a fuddy-duddy. Like, he's just he's an old man that just doesn't understand how, like, why you can't go up to one of your female coworkers and say, look, you owe it to me to get naked. You know, like if there's any justice, like, and he, I think he thinks that this should be seen as like a Don Draper play, where it's just kind of like a compliment that can be playfully dismissed, or hey, if it's like then maybe we pursue it. I just like this episode. Like there's a couple of interesting topics that the episode touches on that I thought were interesting in spite of itself, but I don't know that they were the points that Matthew Weiner wanted to make. For example, there's a particular type of this especially privileged liberal culture that's extremely brittle that the episode kind of made fun of, like the fact that they highlight one of the kids throws into the mom's face, well, you fired a servant for breaking a dish. And she's like, well, no, I didn't. I fired her because it was a special dish and it was a fancy Romanoff dish. And also she tried to blame one of the kids for it, which I get it. That's a lie, and like housekeeping requires a certain amount of trust, but Jesus Christ, how do you make all those words coming out of your mouth without realizing that you're a master in this servant type of relationship, and that itself, like the fact that you're trying to articulate all this stuff is something that maybe should give you pause. The fact that she needed and wanted and like and cited as a moment of David really being there for her is when she bought this fucking castle in probably wine country of California, and David was there to assure her that, no, look, you guys have worked so hard and you've had all this stuff coming to you. And you know, she was kind of onto something about like, you know, we've really been lucky versus no, you were meant to be here. The father, like, as soon as he found out that David had been like accused of doing something inappropriate to children, was kind of like, I knew it, a fucking gay piano teacher, right? Come on, I never thought that was a good idea. It's like some of these people, you scratch the thinnest of the surfaces and you reveal how much their kind of high-minded ideals are essentially bullshit or essentially a veneer, right?
Mm-hmm.
How like quickly Diane Lang took offense when a teacher suggested that her own life choices could be having a negative impact on her child and his fitting in, and how quick she was to dismiss pretty extreme behavior, getting naked and running around in the class as like, oh, you know, kids. And I just thought, and also like to put a bow on the dad's like complete turnaround when the inappropriate conduct became supplying a 16-year-old with alcohol rather than touching their privates.
Mm.
He's like, oh, well, inappropriate contact. Shit, I did that as a... Like, I mean, I'm not saying that buying a kid a beer is worse than touching their pee-pee or better or anything. It's pretty concerning behavior, though, right?
It is. I mean, here's where I come down on this. I don't think it's like... Especially... So when you look at it from the kid's perspective, okay, this is a 15-year-old. The kid wants beer, wants to try it, whatever, is going to someone that he trusts that could potentially get him that beer, that whiskey, that whatever kind of alcohol it was. That is totally understandable from the kid's side. What is not understandable is the adult indulging that kid and getting that for them.
Yes.
Whether there's anything otherwise inappropriate or not going on, or even the potential for that, like, that adult should know better, right?
Yeah, and also that, like, I'm glad Ron Livingston didn't hit the skids when he was 16 and started drinking, but, you know, some people are genetically predisposed to do so, and his idea of harmless fun could wreck a career, that could wreck a person's life that hadn't yet begun.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, that's what I'm saying, like, these fucking people, you know, they're the worst type of, like, kind of helicopter hover parents, but also, like, well, shit didn't kill me when I was a kid, so, you know, we didn't have to wear seat belts when we were growing up. Like, it's that kind of weird, yeah, just because you ran the evolutionary gauntlet doesn't mean it's okay. And the idea that, like, I didn't feel like I knew what side the script was coming down on any of this stuff, like, and also, there's just a very black and white, like, at the end, you know, Diane Lang's character makes a decision that, well, I'm going to trust this character because it feels right to me, and trust to the extent that I'm just going to close the door. Like, I felt that felt like a weird choice, too. Like, you know, there's a reason why I think that more and more schools don't allow that kind of shit to happen. Like, if a teacher's alone with a student, there shouldn't be a door closed, because, you know, that's part of the Me Too thing too, is like, you can't really trust anyone. You can't really give anyone the benefit of the doubt. You do have to kind of act for maximum protection of victims. So I'm not saying that she should yank her kids out of David's class, but I felt like it was appropriate, and especially with the way the law enforcement is acting, to, like, you know, maybe keep the door open, maybe check in, maybe not be like annoying or an asshole about it, but, you know, keep an eye on. And I'm not saying that because David's gay. I'm saying that because he's got a one-on-one relationship with this child. If it was a female teacher, it'd be kind of the same thing, especially if there's kind of some weird, you know, accusation that's happened. And I just felt like that this episode is trying to say something like, hey, one false accusation can wreck a person. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that the so-called victim in this case was this, you know, gay piano teacher who also seemed to be having money trouble, so that an accusation by this powerful family against him would literally probably ruin his career and his life.
Mm-hmm.
Versus Matthew Weiner saying, oh, man, I can't remember if I said she owed it to take my clothes up. Oh, you know, crazy. Who knows? I was busy. Like, even if everyone believed that Matthew Weiner's a creep, it's not going to ruin his life, right?
Probably not. I mean, not in the way that it would ruin the lives of a victim who was actually victimized by, you know, whatever kind of predator it was.
Yeah,
That certainly does more damage than having a false rumor spread about you, obviously.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I think they muddy the waters quite a bit. So, okay, first of all, it's a sad state of affairs that we have to live in a world where you can't trust anybody implicitly. You can't you can't just say, I'm going to close this door with the piano teacher and my child because I trust this person. I don't really want to live in that world. Mm-hmm. Where I have to constantly be suspicious of everyone. Mm-hmm. That would be a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
The episode gets really weird around Ron Livingston's character because he does this 180 and he does it. He almost does it before he finds out that it's alcohol. There's, there's the thing later on where, you know, as a child, he questioned like whether this girl was actually a girl and thought he was a boy and all this stuff.
Right, right.
Now, that taught him the lesson, and his father, you know, furiously instilled it in him, mm-hmm. that he should not go with this mob mentality and just start, you know, doing the same things to these people that other people are doing to them. Mm-hmm. And that's a fine lesson. I think that's good. However, Ron Livingston at the beginning of this episode is very prejudiced against gay people. Very. He tolerated it. He tolerated this gay person in his home teaching his children because his wife, you know, brought this person in, and he didn't want to cause a big scene. And he most importantly didn't want to out himself as homophobic.
Yes.
I think. And
yeah.
So did he ever learn a fucking lesson? Did he learn this lesson as a kid? And then when he gives this self-righteous speech to his children about how, what did you call it? What does he say in there? Is the worst crime?
Bearing false witness.
Bearing false witness being the worst crime possible. I mean, that's what you were fucking doing a half an hour ago, man.
Right.
Like, what lessons have you learned, and what lessons are you going to instill in your children if you don't believe them yourself? So, like, the waters around that guy are so fucking muddy that that character becomes a nothing to me.
Yeah, it's so weird because you'd think if a person, like, if he had really internalized a lesson his father had tried to teach him, that he would have been feeling like this kind of like the shame at the cognitive dissonance of I think this gay piano teacher is a bad idea and always mm-hmm. have, versus like, well, that's exactly what I mean. That's not even what the mob says anymore. Like honestly, people have again, I might be stepping my best, but I feel like in polite society, people have moved on from herder the gays to like herder the trans. And I'm not saying that we can't go back and that, like, you know, we're in this. I should probably stop talking because it's not like anybody in the LGBT community has any kind of firm bedrock of their civil rights being respected in 2018. But you know what I'm saying? Like, in this particular culture, like this very wealthy, elite, liberal culture in California, I certainly think that it's just bizarre. And then the really bizarre thing is he recontextualizes that Alan wasn't a boy. In fact, his name was Ellen and she was a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I almost felt like I was watching in real time Matthew Weiner, number one, being like, well, the accusation's true. And also, well, shit, like, you know, this whole gay panic thing is a little passe. Let me throw in some pronoun debate to add some nuance to this or some shit like that. I'm like, what the fuck? That felt like just a way 180 out of a character that, as you said, already had done a 180. So now, I don't know. Is he a proud boy? What is Ron Livingston's character? I don't get it.
And then there are other problems with this episode. I think the fact. Okay, I don't know that this is actually a problem. I think this episode is focused in a specific place that ignores a lot of the discussion. And to completely exclude what I'm going to have to call the potential victim here, because I don't know whether the accusation was actually true or not. The episode never says it in explicit terms, but it does not concern itself with the potential victim, the child who was, you know, touched or given alcohol or whatever the fuck happened or didn't happen. It simply concerns itself with the ramifications of a false or true accusation. And I guess that's not necessarily a flaw in the episode. It's simply a cordoning off of a particular part of the conversation, which I don't know that you can really have a true conversation, a holistic view of the thing, without taking into account all the angles.
Yeah, and there's a couple – I mean, I think there were some probably interesting things that he could have said about, you know, the Me Too movement in the margins. Cause like it's something I think about, like, what would I do if someone, like a very good friend of mine, was credibly accused by a single woman of something, sexual assault, sexual misconduct, how would I treat that friend? Do you, you know, at, because I think there's a difference between how someone should be treated, like, legally in a court of law, broadly in, like, the court of public opinion, and then you have, like, interpersonal relationships. Like, mm-hmm. you don't want to be the guy who is going golfing with OJ as he's looking for the real killer, but the day that you find out that OJ has wanted for potentially to be a suspect of murder of his wife, do I really expect every one of his friends that have known him for years and years to be like, oh, fuck, jump ship off this Titanic? Like, I mean, and then it gives, there's a lot of nuance. Like, I guess if my friend had, I've seen him make a bunch of make people uncomfortable before, if my reaction is, oh, that sounds plausible, or that doesn't sound at all like XYZ. Those are some things that are interesting to, I guess, contemplate. Like, what if Ron Livingston's buddy in corporate America, he just fired a personal assistant, and it turns out that it was because of sexual harassment, or at least that's the accusation. Like, I mean, I don't know how much navel gazing I'd like to see from Matthew Weiner on that, but that would be at least a coherent story, something mm-hmm. to tell about, something that he could maybe personally wrestle. But the other thing is, like, it's just I don't know when that I've seen it both ways reported in the media that this shit happened. This episode is written before Matthew Weiner's, like, accusation came out, or happened after. But I do kind of feel like, and again, like, I understand there's, like, free speech and artistic arguments may be made on both sides, but, like, I feel like you pack it in on this episode once that accusation comes to light. You know? Like, there's just no...
It does feel a little like self-defense here.
It does. It feels like a wealthy and powerful and privileged man using lavish funds to fight his fight in the court of public opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I couldn't even tell you the woman's name who accused him, and I'm sure she doesn't have a indulgent 8-part Amazon series from which she can launch a detailed critique of the people like Matthew Weiner and how he may or may not move in the television industry. It's like, mm-hmm. it just feels gross, and I feel like it says something about Mr. Weiner that he doesn't get that. Or that he, like, saw this in editing as, like, yep, this is the thing I want to release right now.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I'm not saying he doesn't have the right. I'm not saying he needs to be run out of town on a fucking wagon. I'm just saying that if it were me, I think I would have shelved this part of the project.
Yeah. I don't know. The conversation here is so limited in scope to this idea of the accusation and sort of how people react to the accusation itself. And I think it's pretty devoid of a definitive, did he or didn't he do anything wrong? I look at, like, the cops, right, in this episode, and how, you know, Diane Lane calls her out as being sort of laissez-faire about what to her is an extremely important matter. Mm-hmm. And whether that's, you know, there to try and say something about perhaps how seriously the legal system is taking this accusation because perhaps it's unwarranted, mm-hmm. I don't know. That almost felt like a commentary, like, hey, we should, until the law, like, really wants to dig into this and take a look at it, we should probably just ignore it for the most part.
Right.
You know, let them do their thing. And if they're not that serious about it, why should we be?
Right.
But I don't know. The whole thing felt both stilted and also just a little too narrow in focus and sort of icky.
Yeah. And, like, I keep coming back to, like, every single time I talk to men, and it's almost always men, and they want to say, like, well, yeah, but what about these false accusations that can wreck a person's life? It's just such a weird side of the numbers game to be on, because if you grant, like, the most generous interpretation of, like, false accusations regarding sexual misconduct and rape, it's like 10% of the accusations are false. And that's not to say that they're malicious. They're just, like, you know, didn't meet the legal, you know, didn't meet the legal definition or whatever. you know, it's like that still means that 100% of the women coming forward to report these things are going to face doubt and skepticism. You know, when you report a murder and report a theft of your car, people, the police don't come up and be like, yeah, I bet you set this thing on fire to get the insurance money out of it. Like, that's not the first. No one accuses someone of insurance fraud the second they report their car stolen. Although, yeah. I'm sure that happens quite a bit. And it's just a weird asymmetry, especially when you see the very credible and plausible statistics of how many sexual assaults and rapes don't even be reported.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that 100% of them will be met with skepticism and, you know, doubt, not just like in the court of public opinion, but like by police officers and by lawyers and by judges. Like it's a fucking uphill climb, as we've seen recently in the news. So it's like it's just weird to see. It'd be like in the middle of Jim Crow in the South, where like black men were being lynched both legally and extra legally for eyeballing white women, for like someone to do a television show about, well, what about the white women who are actually raped by hypersexual black men?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what the fuck? Like, okay, maybe that happens. Maybe it's a problem, but how about the dudes getting torched and blow getting strung up and blowtorched in the woods? Like, mm-hmm. that's happened a hell of a lot more, and with a sense of like official, like that's the kind of the policy. And I don't know. It just I do know. I think it's a bad look, Matthew Weiner, and I think you're getting round the criticism on the internet because of it. Especially since this is part of kind of a shaping up to be a mediocre project.
No, it does feel very much like Weiner. And I know he's got a co-writer on this, but I can't help but feel like this is in large part his creation. I think he's trying to talk to the people who are in power. Like, I look at the James Gunn stuff, right? And I know this isn't like involved with the Me Too thing. It's just him kind of being a general asshole 11 years ago or whatever.
Right, right.
But he got fired from his TV show, and it was all, you know, over something that he apologized for. It was something like a big deal was made about it, and he got fired. And I feel like Matthew Weiner in this episode is talking to sort of the executives at Disney, right? Or not even that specifically, but people with power who would be confronted with decisions to make around these kinds of issues in regards to their employees or their friends. And he's saying, let's not be too hasty to jump to conclusions here. That's very much what it felt like to me. And I mean, there is something. So here's the Romanoff tie, I guess, is that power imbalance. You know, these are very powerful people in a powerful place. And in this case, the power that this woman has is to essentially destroy the ability for the piano teacher to do the thing that he loves doing, which is teaching piano and bringing, you know, that peace and that joy to
when he's
to
still
kids.
Very much trying to make that dream happen.
Exactly. Yeah. And she could crumble that to dust by simply saying, you're fired, you know, and then everybody else would in turn fire him. Everybody would right down the line, ruin his dream. And that to me is where the core of this episode lies, in the idea that if you do that, if you were in a position to do that and you do that without thinking, then you've probably made a mistake. And he's not saying don't do it. He's simply saying think about it before you do it.
Right.
And I guess that's, in my opinion, that's perhaps the most interesting thing that this episode does. But it's certainly not the only thing.
Yeah, and I don't even know what that, like, what is the appropriate amount of, like, I feel like, what do you do if you are Diane Lang? You know, I mean, it seems like obviously asking your children, but like maybe not in a, like, this is a tribunal, you must give up in kind of an open and, hey, what do you think about David and how does he make you feel as a person and all that? Like, I mean, I just.
I feel you, man.
I feel like I'm trying to clean this up to be a decently informed afternoon school special, which I think is the problem, because the way this thing is pitched is it just feels like that kind of out of touch, And I don't know, because like the kids, like I felt like the kids' reactions were really good, and they felt, so that's what I'm saying. It's like I'm not so sure that Matthew Weiner is not punching in the right direction. That he's not look at how hypocritical we can be, you know, in our privilege, if with all of our privilege, and we can. You know, we can take this person down without any, and we can do so much damage. But I don't know, it doesn't feel that way, and it feels like you can make an argument through a lot of different sides, and it's a nuanced conversation to have, and that's what I'm coming back and coming down and asking myself is, do I think that Matthew Weiner has the nuance to do this particular after school special? And I think my answer is definitely no.
My answer would be the conversation he's having is too narrow to actually do that. And he almost needed, I don't know how long this episode was. It didn't feel like an hour and a half, but
it was like an hour and 10, I think.
Okay. Maybe he needed that other 20 minutes to bring in the other sides, or not even sides.
Imagine.
Is the wrong fucking word.
I was squirming and like, I kept on hoping that this would, that there would be, cause like sometimes this honestly, having this conversation is always uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I've watched like BoJack Horseman episodes and Lady Dynamite episodes and the other pieces of television that are having these same kind of conversations, because it's one of the biggest cultural events we've had. And it's like you're kind of like, oh God, this seems like it's because like to fully articulate and to illuminate the awfulness of the problem, you have to kind of go down there and roll in the mud a bit. And, like, there's always a point, and I think, in better examples of dealing with this topic where the tide turns and the episode has an actual moral point it tries to make, and then you can kind of decide what you feel about it. This, I felt like it was pretty cringy and uncomfortable from start to finish, and the conclusions it drew were nebulous and debatable, and I don't think you want to... I don't know. Do you want to make a nuanced movie about the Nazis and whether they had points or not?
Right.
They did advance rocket technology and arguably wouldn't have gone to the moon without them. Like, fuck that. Fuck that. You want Indiana Jones melting their faces with the power of God? Like, that's, and I feel like kind of that way when we're talking about people who have, and it's like, it's not just like, it's also about, Because I think that a lot of guys, when they see stuff like this, they think, oh shit, what if I was a staff writer on some show and I'm up and coming? I'm like I'm the piano player in this instance, and a female that's maybe higher than me, maybe lower than me, maybe she just gets jealous and she gives this false accusation, and now I'm fucking ruined and no one will hire me, and I just. That's not really what happens. What happens is, like, the men who still are on top of these organizations calling the shots are the ones that will ask a female to take the clothes off, and then she gets uncomfortable and start and is weirded out by it, and then suddenly she's shown the door because she's not a team player, or she can't take a joke, or like that's the shit that's happening 99% of the time. And guys who are getting taken down, usually justifiably, I'm not saying that there haven't been misfires, but like a good 95% have been very wealthy and privileged guys taken down and hoisted on their own petard because they should be, because they actually did do the things that they did, and were credibly accused of. I feel like it's the wrong messenger, tone deaf message, inartfully told. There's one other thing I want to talk about. That I felt like that one of the things that Matthew Weiner tried to do is introduce David as a problematic victim because he bullshits, he makes up stories to impress his wealthy patron clientele. He may have embezzled funds from his wealthy patrons to try to get a music studio off, but like that also could just be him being a bullshit artist, and he's poor, which causes him to act in sketchy ways to wealthy people, such as taking, like, I thought that was like a funny, I don't know if it's intentionally or unintentionally, Ron Livingston talking about all the freaks he gets dropped off, and Diane Lang's like, well, those are like Uber drivers. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I felt like that there that those were the facts that kind of made David seem shady, and like, really? That I did that he's trying to play a part to you rich people, and that he has to take an Uber because his car breaks down and he doesn't have the funds on hand to just fix it. Mm-hmm. I thought that was such a weird thing to try to shade and add nuance. It wasn't like, because you know, you talk to all of the, it seems like you talk to all the parents and all the kids, and Dave's a saint, right?
Yeah.
That should be like into the story, but instead it's all like, well, he did tell that one lie about being a Romanoff, and then, you know, like, did you loan him this? Like, there's all this meta bullshit. Like honest people can molest children. Mm-hmm. Rich people can certainly molest the shit out of children, as we've seen time and time again. Like, this is all a bunch of red herring bullshit.
Yeah.
And then why was ants crawling all over Diane Lang? That was like supposed to be the pricks of her conscience or something.
Yeah, I mean, that was depicting, you know, the idea that's lingering, even though there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Which kind of follows through the end of the episode. So coming away from this episode, I was 100 and 700 other percent of not looking forward to this podcast, because here's the thing. It's weird because I don't want to come away from, I have a natural instinct to not come away from this episode with anything positive to say. Mm-hmm. And it's a strange position to be in, where I have to get on the microphone and I have to talk about this episode because it's mm-hmm. part of my job. Mm-hmm. And yet I don't want to present any nuanced opinion on this. What I want to do is sort of go with the mob mentality and say, mm-hmm. everything about this episode is stupid and wrong because Matthew Weiner is a dickhead. Mm-hmm. And he's been accused of this thing. I don't know whether he did it or not, but we should believe the victim, and boom, case closed. I have that opinion because I very much don't give a shit what incels think of me, right? Like, mm-hmm. those people are fucking lunatics and idiots. Mm-hmm. Who cares if they go, oh, well, Matthew Weiner has a point here and blah, 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 blah.
Right.
What I care about is the people who do have a lot of interest in seeing the Me Too movement succeed, whatever that means. So I want to come to this with a lot of negativity that... It in some ways is real, and in some ways is artificial. It's like, I don't know how to have like a super honest, nuanced, interesting conversation about this episode without potentially offending people. And that's not my intention. It's not what I want to do, but I know it will happen. Right.
Yeah.
So I get super nervous on these podcasts because I don't want to say the wrong thing, but the wrong thing is so easy to say when you're trying to have a nuanced discussion about something.
I definitely feel you because, and I think that part of the problem is, I think Matthew Weiner tried to, and again, his very old, out of touch, fuddy duddy way, tried to defend preemptively against some of this stuff and try to give it nuance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I honestly think this would, he could have said something interesting if he had just like, hey, as a rich, powerful mogul in television, this is how I really see this situation. This is how I see it. Like, it might have been just as inflammatory, but I think that people wouldn't dismiss it as easy, because this episode is what I see a lot is like, yeah, people just dismissing, like, this is just mediocre entertainment that's had a lot of money spent, a lot of talent spent on it, and it doesn't have anything worthwhile to say, and it's flirting with saying things that are regressive and bad.
Well, why do you think Matthew Weiner is not trying to say the thing that this episode says?
What do you mean?
I mean, you're saying that maybe he should have come out and said the thing that he really feels about it, but
I should defend that thesis a bit. I feel like a lot of us saying like, what the fuck is going on with Ron Livingston? I suspect those were late minute additions to try to add some, look at what people said, like, look at what our parents said about this, and it turns out things are a lot more complex 30 years later. Like, you know, sometimes boys are girls, and sometimes girls are boys, and sometimes you can't tell the... Like, I felt like all that shit came out of left field, and that was something that he was like, sometimes you live through eras, and your parents are trying their best to be progressive, but they overshoot, or they do something, and they teach you a truth that's not true, or something. Again, I don't think that makes what this point is better, but I do think those are attempts of a guy who fundamentally, again, and some of this stuff is meta because, again, I think a guy who really understands what's going on with Me Too and his place in it would not issue one of those half-assed, well, I don't know if I remember, or like, well, you know, maybe I could see something like that, or, well, I wasn't necessarily always a good person. Like, it wouldn't be like this non-apology apology. So I guess I'm metagaming a little bit and seeing how he publicly reacted to an actual Me Too accusation and extrapolating him defensively directing and writing this episode. And maybe that doesn't have any validity, but shit, I don't exist in a vacuum in neither of this episodes. So I think it's fair to bring mm-hmm. in what I think is a dishonest and dissembling and not forthright. Like, Jesus Christ, I actually think that the playbook for this stuff, and it's too bad I'm using the words playbook when, like, it's entirely possible for people to do this, like, in not a calculated way, but everyone knows the shit that they did, man, unless there's some substance abuse issue that's thrown into it and they're, like, blackout drunk while they're in the writer's room or whatever. Like, everyone knows the things that they did. And the other thing that I take as a bedrock is in this Me Too era is usually there's not like a lone thing. Like if David molested a kid in piano, I don't think it would be a single thing that he did. Because mm-hmm. usually people that have these kind of proclivities, you know, they cautiously flex their power. They find out that they get away with it. And then they less cautiously flex their power. And then that's how you get, you know, Harvey Weinstein, right? Mm-hmm. Or a guy who just is fucking gross. Or it's how you get what's that Matt Lauer guy on the Today Show where he's got like a door that he can lock with a button and he's got, you know, the sexual harassment chamber that he's built in the NBC studios. Like, that's how you get to that kind of extreme shit. And it's like just like in this day where you if someone says, hey, you did something that made me feel uncomfortable and hurt me, to say, well, maybe I did, maybe I don't. Who can say? Times are so confusing. That's a fundamentally dishonest horseshit answer. And that's the guy who made this episode. Is that kind of like...
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
At risk of defending or playing the wrong advocate here, I'm gonna throw something out.
Do it.
Maybe, is there any possibility here that we should be giving a little bit of credit for someone who is powerful, someone who is in the position of Matthew Weiner, simply raising the conversation in a very public medium? Does that not have any value, I guess, is my question.
It's not that
where would you attribute that value? Is it to Matthew Weiner? Is that his intention? Or is it simply a byproduct of this thing that he made?
Well, so why is it the old powerful rich guys place to make this stand? Like, because
I'm saying is bringing it to people who may not have been touched by it yet and may not have ever thought of it.
Well, so I guess here's my critique to that, and because I think you're onto something, and what I think is true is that Mr. Weiner has access to hundreds and hundreds of people in this community, you know, women that he could have like floated these ideas for an episode to, and he could have sought out critiques that like, oh God, no, Matt, no, you can't say that. He could have actually used his platform to make something really interesting and really thought provoking and maybe made people feel uncomfortable and like put, or he might have like, you know, he might have gotten the answer of like, just like, look, dude, you can't be this guy. You can't be the guy who makes this at this time because of X, Y, Z, you know, societal reason, political reason, whatever. But I think what he did probably is just did this almost entirely by himself. You know, and here's another thing that's going to sound kind of gross and prejudiced, but fuck it. It's one of the honestly first thoughts I had is when I saw a woman's name attached to the script, I'm thinking, he used you as a fucking sandbag.
Right. Yeah, shield.
As a pillbox to like, oh, well, you know, if shit, a woman, like, she was my co-writer, so like, why doesn't she get it? You know, it's like that it all comes across as feeling calculated, because mm-hmm. it's clear that if you talk to women in Hollywood, he sure didn't talk to like a preponderance of women that would give him 180 degree or like a 360 degree evaluation of how this would come across.
Yeah,
I think. Or gay, you know, or like, you know, what is it like, you know, like if you want to talk about gay people being falsely accused of child molestation, there's probably people that can talk about that, because that's like, I think that's still a real thing in society. Like people, you know, are skeptical of men around children, period. You know, I felt that when I'm at a playground with my son when he was real little and I'm the only guy there and I'm this big dude with a beard and I'm like, and I could see the moms kind of like sizing me up and like what, and like having conversations about me. And then Jack would run over and be like, daddy, daddy. And like, I could see them visibly relax. Like, I mean, I get it. There are definitely some bullshit things that our society have towards men, and I imagine gay men, it goes double or treble. But I just feel like it. Yeah, when you've got this much power and prestige and talent and money, it's just disappointing to see something that's kind of like a mumble mouth. Well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Instead of like a really sharp, focused statement that actually would move the ball one way or another in society. Yeah. So. That's kind of like, yeah, I think he could have done better. It's just, it's at best a squandered opportunity. Mm-hmm. Unless these, you know, again, maybe this is all his honest thoughts. And then, boy, I just think he needs to do a lot more thinking.
yeah.
So that's always possible too. All right. Before we get to feedback, I want to talk about our club at club.baldmove.com. There's a lot of special features you can get for joining up. One of the special features is it gives Jim and I the ability to cover small shows like the Romanoffs that you're enjoying right now. But we also have a lot of special features. For example, right now we're going through Season of the Cage. Previous week's entries like for Con Air and Weatherman had us for special club content pitching sequels to the movies or reimagining the movie. Adaptation confounded our attempts to do that. So instead, we provide our club members with a slightly expanded conversation in our deep dive movie review podcast, where we have 20 plus bonus minutes of coverage exclusively for our club members. You can sign up at club.baldmove.com. It's super easy. You can get a preview for a lot of the special features like ad-free feeds and video versions of our podcast, Lunch with Jim and Aaron, Quit Your Pitching, First Run Movies, etc., etc. You can also try for free 30 days by signing up for your membership risk-free. Check it out at club.baldmove.com.
I'm ready for feedback.
Actually, this is the first time it's happened as we're covering this show, but we actually got a lot of post feedback on our episode for last, or on our podcast episode for the last episode, episode 4, Expectation. First up, an anonymous dad says, "This episode really hit me close to home because I'm a father of a 19-year-old daughter who I've suspected for most of my life, or her life, that she is not my biological daughter. I won't go into all the details, but I've long ago lived to accept this, and nothing will ever change or happen to change my view and or relationship with my daughter. But I wanted to comment about the what if he, the son-in-law, has to give blood comment made by the mother at breakfast. I've always had a fear that although I've made peace with the possible secret about my daughter, that the truth may need to come out suddenly someday because of a medical procedure that requires a donor of some kind, and it'd be something that would typically be taken from a family member but not work because I'm not the biological father. I have no idea if this is what the wiener was referencing with that line, but my mind immediately went back to that as soon as the main plot took hold." I don't know if I can assuage your fear here, anonymous dad, but it's my understanding that like if it came time to like you donating a kidney to your daughter, sometimes not every parent would be an exact match, right?
Oh, I don't know.
Like I don't know, but like to the extent that that's like, I'm trying to tell this guy's like, well, maybe that's not a real fear. Like, you know, like I don't have the same, I don't think blood type as my parents. But anyway, huh.
I got an easy solution for you.
Yeah.
And I swear I'm not making fun of this, but I have to say it. You could simply, so if the girl's mother has a self-interest in preserving the secret, you could simply do some kind of contract that would say you need to be the first donor on this kind of thing.
Mm, mm.
you know, because if you present that contract and, you know, and she doesn't want the news to come out, then she's probably just going to sign it. And, you know, eventually you'll be off the hook for the kidney or the blood or whatever you got to do.
Yeah, I just figured there'd be a blood test. I mean, I guess that's the other big fear, is you do a blood test and the doctor, I mean, if you do, especially if you like, say, like she's 19 years old, so she's a legal adult, and they do a blood test and you don't match, or it's like, you're like, would they tell the daughter? I guess
right.
they would.
That would
be the real fear there. Just the, like the testing of procedure would out you in a way that would hurt your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, that.
Yeah, because it's not going to hurt you. Obviously, you've like you said, come to terms with it. So,
but on the other hand, I think that the older she gets, the more like even if she this comes out, like she's going to look mm-hmm. back on her life and think, biology be damned. You know, like a DNA test isn't going to tell me, you know, who my dad was or was not. So
mm-hmm.
it's interesting though, because that's the thing. I'm open to the idea that these are very personal episodes and they might hit people right in a particular thing that makes it more meaningful to that individual than it would like all of us. Because like, you know, you and I had minor differences of how, well, not minor. You liked the episode, last episode a lot more than I did.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's kind of like on the balance, this Romanoff thing. It's certainly not hitting people as broadly as like, say, Mad Men, which is kind of itself an acquired taste.
Yeah.
So... someone on the forum linked a review from Alan Sepinwall, and I didn't have time to read the whole one, but they quoted a single part that went along the lines of, it's very clear after five episodes that this was a project that Matthew Weiner didn't get told no very often on.
Yeah.
To like maybe, and you think of like who picked this up, Amazon. I could see Amazon being like, hey, follow up the Mad Men. It's all on you, Matt. Do whatever you want. And we've seen that a lot of times where you give a creator that kind of unfettered, you know, freedom. I feel like that was a problem with True Detective Season 2. I feel mm-hmm. that's a problem with George Lucas coming back to Star Wars. Sometimes real creativity is born from like hardships and limitations and creative compromises, and giving someone like everything they need can breed kind of laziness and shallow takes and shallow thinking. Moving on, Heather H. Boy, she's got a grand unification theory for Romanoff. So are you ready for this, Jim?
Yeah, bring it.
You have a whiteboard and some red yarn to make these connections.
Sure.
In this episode, we get a moment that you guys didn't talk about. And again, she's talking about episode 4. Slattery's Daniel, while walking down the street in the first scene where he and Preet's Julia are physically together in the present day, confides in her that his Romanoff book has sold as a miniseries script, which is great news. But can't we safely assume that the miniseries that comprised the whole episode of episode 3, The House of Special Purpose, is in fact that book? If so, this means that Daniel writes the book that becomes a script and the context in which the events of House of Special Purpose occur.
Wait, I'm not following it. So are they saying that Slattery in this case is Matthew Weiner and Weiner
no,
and that
no.
this is the Romanoffs that he's writing?
No. She's trying to find a way to connect all of these episodes together.
Okay.
So Slattery wrote a book that's picked up to be shot as a miniseries that Christina Hendricks got signed for and
Okay. I didn't realize the Hendricks connection.
So this is the context in which Christina Hendricks' Olivia will die, or perhaps more appropriately, you should say, will be killed at the hands of the antics of a mad woman director, Jacqueline. Then, of course, Daniel/Slattery also appears in The Royal We, Episode 2, as a distinguished guest speaker in the bizarro freak show Romanoff's Cruise. He's speaking as an expert using the very book of his that is the basis for the miniseries script from House of Special Purpose. Importantly, in Expectations, he and Julia find that book in a near-dusty sales bin on a bookstore sidewalk selling for just $1, a fact that he openly laments. The book's obviously run its course in the timeline and the world of New York City's Expectation, but it's all the rage in the timeline and world of the Romanoff's Cruise in The Royal We, or at least in the context of a Romanoff cruise.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is all to be pieced together, you can almost start to map a circulation of the curse of the Romanoffs. Daniel slash Slattery meets his best friend, Eric slash Tinney, who supposedly or self-proclaims as a Romanoff descendant, and eventually becomes some kind of scholarly expert of Romanoff lore. He writes a book that becomes all the rage in the weirdo Romanoff crew circuit, and God knows where else strange supposed Romanoff folks go to celebrate the Romanoffness. Meanwhile, he has an affair with Eric's wife, Julia slash Preet, and she gets pregnant and has Ella slash Rudd, but stays with Eric, the supposed actual Romanoff. That's all a big secret that eats away at Daniel and Julia. Daniel devolves into unhappiness, which probably involves more of these Romanoff cruise gigs, and his book gets less and less popular until, boom, he sells the book rights to a mad set of folks who end up hiring yet another unstable person who believes themselves to be Romanoff's descendant, and she makes a miniseries under unethical and nutso conditions where she literally kills someone. Moral, the Romanoff's curse slash psychic trauma not only infects the families from which it resides, but it circulates and sticks to all those who touch it. They pass it on and cannot escape it, and it has the deadliest or more dramatic effects on those who are not interested in it or who are not part of it until they are captured by someone who carries the curse, such as Hendrix Olivia, Preet's Julia, Bishay's Shelley in The Royal We. Until they end up awful people dead or trying to run as far away as they can get from them. What do you think about the Romanoffs as a curse that spread, like almost like the ring style through a community?
Yeah, I mean, it tracks. I mean, that's kind of the thesis of the show, right? That it all sort of this trauma is following these people around. I guess, like, if you want to say, oh, it's cursed, it sticks to even the people around it who are unfortunate enough to come in contact with the Romanoffs. Mm-hmm. You could extend it, and I certainly buy, you know, the framework that the emailer has built here. But yeah, I don't know. I was always under the impression from the beginning that was kind of the thing of this show, right?
Yeah, I thought that there's going to be a through line, but now that we've seen, for example, Diane Lang shows up in here, and she's like a wealthy mom in the California coast, but she also showed up in a previous episode as a person that hobnobs with a man with Pete's character, and I wonder, are you supposed to understand that they are literally the same person, that Diane Lang just happened to be in town? Because I do kind of like the idea that all of these would be tied together, not just thematically, but also like they inhabit the same universe and these characters kind of like crisscross in and out of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And which would make the first episode be the only one that so far has none of those connections.
Yeah, seems like it.
But then again, there's still three episodes left where they can do that. Anyway, Heather concludes, I'm a professor of rhetoric and film, and my scholarly focus is on violence, so I'm fascinated by the possibility that the Weiner may actually pull off some sort of interesting series that provocatively ponders how the violent moment of Romanoff's demise, historically speaking, could infect the entire symbolic understanding people have of themselves today, from how they dress, to who they marry, to how they vacation, to what they choose as a career, and how they approach their work style. Despite the near historical impossibility based on the facts that they have any blood relation to real Romanoffs.
Man, I can't help but think that it would have been, if that's the thesis that he's going for, it would have been much better served by something serialized. Something
yeah.
that we focus on characters that we can learn and grow with and appreciate to a fuller extent than we can these, what frankly have been flimsy characters and ephemeral characters. You know, they're here one episode, gone the next.
Yeah, when you were lamenting the fact that you have to do a podcast on this and kind of you know, there with this format, there's a limited amount of talk. You can talk about the thing's point of view or its politics or it did, like, I was thinking, like, yeah, the thing about, it's one thing to have an anthology like American Horror Story where every season is going to be something different, maybe there's some loose connections, but within the season itself you can say, okay, after having seen the three episodes I've seen, I predict that this is what's going to happen. Where the whole fucking thing's an anthology and nothing's really connected in any kind of concrete, it's like I can't even say, well, this is kind of a turd of an episode, but it's building towards X, Y, or Z, or I think I can see. I appreciate what Heather's doing here is just trying to, like, you know, do like a meta analysis approach to do that. But man, I've really realized what a big part of our podcast is just kind of like speculating on what we think is going to happen, or trying to anticipate, like it's, or even when we're not speculating, there's still that anticipation of like, oh, you smell this good meal cooking. I wonder what's going to come. Like, that's always part of the fun. Even when we're not engaging in like real speculation, like they're building towards something. Whereas this, it's just each individual thing either works or it doesn't. And then it doesn't feel like it's adding up to anything greater or lesser than itself.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe he's going to go try and stick the landing in the next three episodes and really tie it all together, but I honestly don't see how.
Yeah, it's getting less and less likely. My jam, I felt like I was watching some sort of Bizarro World After School special at the end of this one. So this is where we turn and start talking about the High and Bright Circle. The worst sin you can do is bear false witness. Who bore false witness in this episode? Only the piano teacher that we know of when he pretended to be a Romanoff. Everyone else was reacting fairly open-mindedly and reasonably to a suspicion that was raised about the piano teacher not bearing false witness. It's so weird and off-tone, especially with Matthew Weiner's recent past of being accused of inappropriate behavior. Was he making a case about how the accusation ruined his real life? Then why did he put the story of the Allen kid, who was actually a girl, which was a confusing non sequitur more than a parable, that clarified any point he was trying to make? And why did he make the piano teacher sketchy enough to where Diane Lang should have had her guard up more and not closed the door in a piano session? And yes, we all know people can make up accusations about other people if they want to, and that is wrong, but this episode completely dismisses the victim's point of view, and dismisses the inappropriate behavior, and worse, happens frequently in real life. And that the very nature of these inappropriate actions and crimes make it so there is not likely to be any witnesses, and there is not much else victims can do but report it and know that they will often face disbelief at best and retribution at worst. I think, yeah, these are things that we all kind of touched about. I guess something I haven't reflected is that there is a weird disconnect between Me Too and the opponents of Me Too, which is there is no pocket in society where people are saying it's cool to make false accusations about people.
Mm-hmm.
There is not a segment of society that says that that is something that's okay to do. Yet it's very easy to point to examples, even in popular culture, which I think we all would agree reflects society, where, you know, look in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, and even today, like how many women in job situations are portrayed as being sexually harassed? How many to show that they have sleazy bosses? How many have, you know, boyfriends that have, you know, sexually abused or mistreated them? And how many of those plot points were resolved by the women going to authorities and getting justice? Like, you can make an argument that there is a big swath of society who doesn't want to hear any of this Me Too bullshit, but there's no corresponding segment on the other side that's like, yeah, ladies, get even. Just falsely accuse these guys and fucking ruin their life.
Right.
Like, yeah, no one is teaching their children, well, Sally, when you grow up, you just tell a man that he touched your boob and everything will be right as rain. Like, the fuck.
So this email, when it mentioned Ron Livingston and his character, I got trapped in a thought cycle here in my own head, and I wonder now, I'm questioning whether or not Ron Livingston is supposed to be a hypocrite and a joke in this episode, if he is not the character who we're supposed to look at and say, what a dumbass, because, like I pointed out earlier, you know, this he seems to have learned nothing from the lessons of his childhood. And he's now getting up on his high horse and telling his kids to do the same thing that he did not learn himself. There are moments, you know, in this episode where he assumes, oh, because he's gay, he must be a molester. There are moments in this episode where he says, oh, the women don't have anything to do because they don't work. And so they gossip all the time. He's kind of a shit in just about every direction you want to approach it from.
Has a lot of regressive views, yes.
Yeah. Are we sure that Matthew Weiner is not dumping a bunch of bullshit opinions into this character and saying this character is not supposed to be taken seriously in any way?
I mean, yeah, that's what I was trying to go with, like, you know, charitable interpretations of what he's trying to say. But I guess it's still muddied by the fact that I feel like Diane Lang has a lot of shitty opinions and reactions of things too. Like, who is the only person that I feel is acting in a righteous way is the children. But even then, they had this like, well, things are weird now, so I don't want him to be my instructor. Like, mm-hmm. they had the thing where Livingston had to come and be like, look, you shits, this is false bearing or witness, and that's Jesus himself said that's the worst thing you can do about a person. When I was writing my notes, I was looking for the alternate take that there's a clear through line, like, you know, you fucking coastal liberal elites are trying to nail Matthew Weiner to the wall, because if you actually look from this certain admittedly weird and skewed position, there is a through line of righteousness that's just not there. Like, that through line takes 90 degrees. It's like the magic bullet in JFK. it stops for 2 seconds, turns 90 degrees, continues 6 inches, goes through JFK's dick hole, and gets accused of touching his penis. It's weird. I really tried to do it because I was thinking, like, as I was writing my notes, there's this mess of all these different contradictory opinions, and I'm like, I wonder if he is doing something like that. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't find it. Yeah. I have a whole like page and a half of stuff where I was trying to, and it just didn't come together.
I mean, that's the problem with it, right? Too, because all of the opinions that he's expressing are kind of those regressive opinions that you sort of expect from an older man.
Yeah,
and I wouldn't necessarily put it past Matthew Weiner to actually have those opinions and honestly hold them. So, like, I don't know where to come down. Has Matthew Weiner like examined the culture of his childhood and said this is a negative thing, or has he looked at it and he's like classical music and like fancy poetry and fancy whiskey and wine,
yeah,
is holding it up as a thing to be lauded? And I don't know the true answer there.
Yeah, and it's also very, this is a lot of like 101, or these are the first three chess moves made in this debate, and mm-hmm. the course of the debate is well into its end game at this point. And I feel like, but the thing is, there's also, if you want to do that, it's not like that doesn't have value, because I do very strongly feel, as a person who was born with a bunch of shitty default opinions because of where I was born, the community I was raised in, the things I was taught as a child, like I had certain bits flipped to places that I wish I'd been born with them flipped the other way. So like there's always these people that I think are well-meaning, and if you present them in what I consider the true facts in a way that is easy to digest and something that helps them kind of like make parallels to their own life or the things that they can, you know, kind of generate empathy for these positions, that has value. Like sometimes taking mm-hmm. things back to the opening of a chess move where, you know, white moves their pawn two spaces ahead on the king rank or whatever. That stuff has value, but he's like, I just felt like he doesn't know enough to like break it down, or his understanding of the game theory is such that, like, because you have to do that, you have to know pretty well the mid and end game to explain like why this opening is good or not good, right? Mm-hmm. But the way he did it, it's almost like, I don't know. I mean, if that's what he wanted to do, I feel like it's a flip of the coin whether you walked away from this episode having a better understanding of what you should actually believe or what Matthew Weiner thinks or hopes you should believe. And that's what kind of makes it bad. Cause I do see sometimes, you know, in certain spheres of like leftist progressive politics where they get upset when like the 101 arguments are made. It's like, Jesus Christ, why are we? Well, it's because a lot of the country still needs that one. Like you can't, like every year there's a 100 level biology, mm-hmm. and you don't see like masters and doctors of biology coming down and bemoan, what the fuck is another class of 19-year-old dumbasses taking intro to biology for? But you do see that sometimes in like these social movements, because mm-hmm. I guess if I put on my empathy hat, it's because it's depressing to see so much work left to be done. Mm. Or like the state of the debate in some circles, but it is what it is. You know, you have to, not everyone's born thinking correct things. Everyone needs to be taught. Everything needs to be educated. And if you're born with like, you know, you for whatever stroke of luck, you're born with the correct viewpoints for society of today, then I guess congratulations. But I think some of those people are going to have a harder time later in life when their challenges, when their viewpoints are challenged in other ways, because they're not going to have any kind of history of like, oh, evaluating something critically and changing their mind. It's going to be, you know, those are like people that are going to end up being reactionary. You know, it's like my aunt, you know, my aunt was, got a liberal arts degree in the late '60s, early '70s, absolutely would be a fucking liberal in those contexts. And she's a Trump supporter. Like, you know, so was she a liberal back then because she'd really thought through the issues and had some kind of internal framework that made sense? Or was it just like she went along with what everybody was saying and like, of course that's right? I don't know. It's just, yeah, there's room for 101 type of material, but it's got, you know, breaking things down and teaching. Yeah, it requires a thorough understanding of the material. And I don't think Matthew Weiner has that. Cape Gabe, or maybe it's Carpe Gabe, Cape Gabe. It seems like each episode has less and less of a Romanoff connection. Next episode will feature someone just walking by a magazine clipping of a review of John Slattery's book. Yeah, I guess that's the other thing that's kind of confounding. I thought this was a pretty heavy Romanoff to start off with. I guess I thought that would build, and it seems to be the concentration of Romanoff is getting homeopathic. It's decreasing.
Right. Yeah, I wonder if that's because, you know, there was a promise made with this show, with the title of this show, and Weiner felt like, oh, I need to actually deliver on some of that, so put the strongest Romanoff connection up front.
Yeah, I'm getting to where I need to be a Romanoff shark. I need to be able to detect a one part in a million to, you know. If you put one drop of Romanoff in a 6 million gallon tank, the great white Romanoff will be able to detect it. But it just smells like salt water to me. That's all we got for this week's episode. If you'd like to give us feedback, you can do so at tv@baldmove.com or on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. We have a Romanoff's thread there. But we'll see what happens next Friday when another one is released, and next Monday when we talk about it. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
I'll see you.